From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. First, a quick program note. Over the next week, we present three concerts from Washington, D.C.'s 930 Club. Iggy Pop with the Stooges, Lily Allen with the opening band The Bird and the Bee, and Low with the opening act Lonely Deer. There's also a lot of new music coming out, and we'll get to much of that in an upcoming show. But today, one of my heroes. Back in the day when the typeface on liner notes was larger than a poppy seed, I would see the name Joe Boyd show up over and over again on my favorite British records. Music by The Soft Machine, Fairport Convention, Sandy Denny, and this artist, Nick Drake.
Do you curse where you come from? Do you swear in the night? Would it mean much to you if I treat you right?
Joe Boyd is a record producer, first a lover of old blues when he grew up in the U.S. and went to Harvard, and later when he went to England producing American blues concerts to an appreciative British crowd. Joe Boyd produced some great music, not great hits, and he's written about producing music in a book called White Bicycles, Making Music in the 1960s. The book is filled with stories and vignettes of musicians making their art inspired at times by drugs and fueled by optimism. It's a pleasure to meet you, Joe.
Pleasure to be here.
It really is. I think a lot of people have a different vision of what a record producer does, and certainly record producers have a different vision of what their job is. What do you see your role as a producer?
Well, it's changed a lot. You know, today I meet young musicians who say, oh, wow, you produced Nick Drake or something, Syd Barrett, or, you know. So before you were a record producer, were you an engineer or were you a musician?
Mm-hmm.
And I say, neither. And they look at me wide-eyed, you know. They go, really? Well, what did you do? You know, and I said, I just listened. And I know that's a bit of an oversimplification, but when I started making records, the music business was just evolving from two-track recording to four-track recording. And most recordings were done live in the studio. You didn't have a lot of options for overdubbing.
Right.
And so the job of a producer was, first of all, to make the decision about doing the record. But once you get there, if you have a group of musicians in the studio, you need to give them the kind of energy and the attention and listen in a way that will try to bring out of them the kind of performance they would do in front of a huge crowd. So that if you say, that was really good, but I've heard you do it just that little bit faster, then they do it faster. And they need that feedback when they're recording live. Today, with Pro Tools and all the modern technology, I think artists have become over-obsessed with perfection. And producers now generally work for artists. The artist gets the contract, and then they hire a producer.
Why did you fall in love with going to England?
Well, I was a blues fan in America. And when I got to England, the first night of the concert tour, there was a queue of teenagers outside the dressing room door waiting for Muddy Waters to sign an autograph. And I thought, this was in 1964 when nobody in America had ever heard of Muddy Waters, you know, and I thought, this is the place for me.
And it influenced a whole slew of great bands. I mean, The Animals and Spencer Davis and
yeah, there was,
you know,
it was
all
full
that
of,
stuff was...
It was full of kids listening to these records, trying to play it, and in sort of failing in a way,
yeah.
Making something equally as interesting, or at least really very interesting, you know, whether it was the Rolling Stones
mm-hmm.
or the Beatles, you know, were imitating Little Richard. I mean, you know, that's how they started out. And then they would naturally evolve into writing songs because you don't want to play basic blues forever.
You found pulling together Eric Clapton and a number of other musicians.
I got a great break. I got asked by Elektra Records to go to London and open their European office.
And Elektra was basically a really folky label from, you know, the late 50s?
They started in the late 50s.
But in 1965, 66 especially, they really changed.
They did. They became Paul Rothchild, who was a friend of mine from Harvard Square, went to work for them. And Paul was working on a electric blues project, a compilation that was going to have Butterfield, The Loving Spoonful, Al Kooper, Tom Rush, a few other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, I'm going to London. Save a few tracks for me. I'll find an English blues band. And when I got there, of course, I couldn't find any unsigned bands that were any good because the English labels had signed everybody up. But then I met Paul Jones, and he said, oh, everybody would love to be on one of these records. Let's just, who do you want? Eric Clapton? Yeah, sure, I'll call him. You know, Stevie Winwood? Sure, no problem. And I thought, this is ridiculous. This isn't going to happen. And then 2 days later, he called me back and said, yeah, everybody's up for it. So that was the first record I ever produced.
Can we give a listen to that? This is a song called...
Crossroads.
Crossroads, which is basically a Robert Johnson...
It's two tune. Robert Johnson songs. Eric and I sat around listening to Robert Johnson records one afternoon in my office and trying to choose one that would work for him to play. And he really liked bits of Traveling Riverside Blues mm-hmm. and Crossroads. And he went home and he figured out this arrangement, which took the guitar riff from one and combined it with some lyrics from the other.
They're good players and they're great singers. You started working with a club. It's called the UFO Club. Off of the blues, but somehow related, is music by a group we know as Pink Floyd and music of Syd Barrett. It's a very, I don't know how to relate Syd Barrett quite with the blues, but when I listen to his solo stuff, I hear it. You don't really hear it in something like Arnold Lane.
Well, the interesting thing, though, is one of those English LPs that... my brother and I went out and saved up our pennies and bought. It was a reissue of Blind Boy Fuller. It was had all of the tracks he recorded in the 30s. In the liner notes, it mentions colleagues of Blind Boy Fuller that he was traveling around the back roads of South Carolina mm-hmm. with in the late 20s, early 30s. And they were two singers named Floyd Council and Pink Anderson. And these blues singers on that record is where Syd chose the name Pink Floyd. So they originally set out to be a blues band, but...
Something happened.
Something happened, yeah. I don't know whether it was what Syd was stirring
in the water,
into
right?
his tea. Or, but also, I think they in the summer of 66, they were looking for work in England, and they got commissioned to accompany an artist who did a sort of refracted light through glass and things like that, and needed a kind of performance, and they had to play something abstract, and which I think helped lead them into this wackier, more abstract, more avant-garde world, and also got them so they liked playing in front of a light show. And then they started doing that at these benefit performances in Notting Hill Gate for this local organization, weird kind of 60s idealistic organization called the London Free School. And then the head of that and I got together to do what we'd done in Notting Hill Gate for these benefits, rent a Irish dance hall and put on these shows starring Pink Floyd. And it just exploded. People flocked to it. It became the kind of epicenter of psychedelic London 1967.
It must have been an amazing time, huh?
It was great. You know, one of the things that I tell people trying to describe it is that we were delusional, but having the optimism that we had, you know, the feeling that everything could be changed, you know, that you could do so many incredible things, the world, the earth would provide to everybody. We didn't realize the limits that there were. And so there was this fantastic optimism. And I think that spring of 67 was the kind of height of feeling of possibility. And I think people make really interesting music when they feel that way.
Let's listen to Arnold Lane, which is a quirky little single by Pink Floyd.
Arnold Lane had a strange.
There's an awful lot of drugs that waft throughout this book over and over and over again. And I want to talk to you about the influence of drugs on the creative process as you saw it. And
well, you know, there was some groups it was a factor and some it wasn't. I would say that the Incredible String Band certainly were early adapters, you know, they took to LSD, but in a way that was very much like the people I knew in Harvard Square in the early 60s who maybe knew Timothy Leary, who was teaching at Harvard in the early 60s. And people then had a very sacramental attitude towards hallucinogens. You know, they wouldn't take it casually.
They would go for the weekend and say,
oh. Yeah, and they'd put on a stack of really interesting records to listen to or go to some really beautiful place in nature to be. But by the end of 1967, you had people just tripping all the time, people taking it just to get hammered. And, of course, Syd Barrett became the first person that I think I heard identified as an acid casualty. And LSD itself became adulterated, mixed with amphetamines. The whole thing became a little stranger as an experience, less spiritual. So, and the string band, I think, had definitely had some interesting experiences with hallucinogens. But the Fairport Convention were very straight, very well-behaved, beer-drinking occasionally guys. But Nick Drake, I think, probably smoked a lot of hashish, and that helped to kind of isolate him, I think.
There's a moment in your book where you talk about the band, the American group, the band. I just want to give a listen to something that came out of the record Music from Big Pink. We'll go from there.
I pulled into Nazareth, was feeling about half past dead. I just need some place where I can lay my head. Hey, mister, can you tell me where a man might find a bed? He just grinned and shook my hand. No was all he said. Take a load off, Fanny. Take a load for free. Take a load off, Fanny. And you put the load right on.
It is impossible to underestimate the impact that that record had in England when it came out. You'd walk down King's Road and you'd see musicians walking by with Big Pink under their arm. I mean, everybody had this record and everybody was talking about it. It was such an important record, I think, because before that, I think there had been this feeling that it's all one big transatlantic world, but Fairport Convention were trying very hard to be a sort of English version of an American West Coast band, and they were singing Joni Mitchell songs and Bob Dylan songs. And this record hit them like a ton of bricks, I think, because it was so roots American. But it was new. I mean, obviously, there have been people like Ronnie Hawkins and Carl Perkins and all white guys playing a kind of country blues rock thing. But this was different because these were very influenced by Dylan. It was influenced by taking dope. It was influenced by living the life of the mid-60s, you know, kind of, I don't know, the whole countercultural revolution is in that record, as well as the deep roots of American music. And Fairport realized that they just couldn't compete. That's just it. Slam the door. And then I think the idea that they came up with was really to make a record that is as English as Big Pink is American.
And you had involvement in the record called On Half Bricking, yeah?
Well, yeah, that was the first toe in the water. They did On Half Bricking for me is still probably maybe the best Fairport record because it was a mature record by a group that had a number of strings to its bow. And just before that record came out, they had this terrible accident and the drummer was killed. And they felt, Martin Lamble, they felt they couldn't do these songs anymore. They had to have a complete clean sweep of the repertoire. And that's when they came up with the repertoire that you hear on Legion Leaf, which has become a very important record, certainly in England, you know, for showing how you can combine English roots with modern music.
Let's give a listen to a record that really brought on the beginning of great British folk music and drawing from the tradition. What song should we listen to?
Well, when I went back to listen to Legion Leaf to choose things for this compilation that came out with the book called White Bicycles as well, I was surprised because the one I really was impressed with was this track called The Deserter, which I hadn't remembered as being one of the outstanding tracks. But when I listened to it, I thought, this is great.
And that incredible voice is the voice of
Sandy Denny.
She has made, for me, just the music that touches my heart almost more than any other singer in England. Just absolutely brilliant. What was she like to work with?
She was great to work with. Very, very smart. Very musical. I was a bit worried when she joined Fairport because I felt that she was such a different character than them, although they were from very similar backgrounds, you know, suburban London, grammar school, sort of middle-class
Muswell
families.
Muswell Hills?
What?
Are they Muswell Hill?
Well, the Fairport Convention are all from Muswell Hill, and Sandy, well, maybe that's the difference. See, Sandy was from south of the river.
Okay.
She was from Wimbledon. But she was as loud as they were quiet. They were well-behaved, nice little boys, and Sandy was a hard-drinking, hard-smoking, cursing, effing, and blinding character, you know, who...
Couldn't tell it when she's singing, though.
No.
I mean, you can tell she's got presence, and she's...
Oh, absolutely. But she, once she joined the group, she was very well-behaved because hearing Richard Thompson play guitar behind her songs, behind her singing... What could be better? You know, she just thought she'd died and gone to heaven. This was great. And they to work with them together in the studio on, I guess it was only three albums, was just fantastic for me.
How would you sum up what you did for or did with Fairport Convention?
Well, I think, you know, there were certain formulae in Britain at the time that groups, pop groups, were supposed to follow. And I think the most important thing I did for Fairport was say, ignore that. And I brought them songs. I introduced them to Joni Mitchell. I knew Joni, and I'd met her at the Newport Folk Festival. And then I also helped them get in touch with the early basement tapes of Dylan. And then when they started getting interested in British folk music and thought, well, what it would be like to have a fiddle on this tune? I said, oh, let's get Dave Swarbrick, because I knew him. And he came down and played on Sailor's Life and eventually joined the band. So I was a kind of an enabler. I didn't push them. I didn't say, let's do an English folk music record. But I encouraged their eccentricities, let's put it that way.
I used to buy imports for a record company, for a chain of record stores. And the imports I would buy most of would be Nick Drake records, because they were always hard to come by. Let's give a listen to a song from Nick Drake.
Betty came by on her way, said she had a word to say about things today and fallen leaves. Said she hadn't heard the news, hadn't had the time to choose a way to lose.
Tell us about Nick Drake and how you met Nick Drake.
Fairport Convention is how I met Nick, really, because they played a benefit concert protesting against the Vietnam War. It was a 24-hour marathon. And Fairport, I believe, played at some civilized hour, like 9 o'clock at night or something. And then they all went home, except Ashley Hutchings, the bass player. He stayed around to hear the other artists. And at some ungodly hour of the morning, Nick Drake came on and played a couple of songs. And Ashley, bless him, said, ooh, that's interesting, and went up to Nick afterwards and said, do you have a phone number? And came into the office the next day and handed me this piece of paper and just said, I think you should call this guy. He's pretty interesting. And so I did, and Nick came in and gave me this tape, and I just flipped. I just thought, this guy's amazing. And so we made a record. You know, I'd seen the way Leonard Cohen had made a record, and he didn't tour at that time, Leonard Cohen. He never performed. And the record sold 100,000 copies. So I said, hey,
yeah,
Nick can do that. And because I knew he was too shy to be an effective performer, or at least it wouldn't be easy for him until there was an... I sort of felt, you put the record out, everybody will love the record, and then you can have small concerts getting to big concerts where people coming just to hear Nick, and then they'll be very respectful.
A lot easier now than there was right. to do that.
But it was very difficult. It didn't work. It didn't happen. And so my only solution was, let's make another record even better. And we tried a lot of interesting combinations. John Cale plays on a couple of tracks, a lot of viola. And then on this track, I had been working with a South African jazz piano player named Chris McGregor, who led the first interracial jazz band in South Africa. And I'd been mixing it all morning with him. And then we finished, and Nick came in and started playing that song. And Chris McGregor was still in the studio. My head was full of the sound of his piano, and as Nick was playing these kind of quite jazzy chords on the guitar, I kept thinking, I can hear Chris's piano on this. So I said, how do you feel? Would you like to play on this? And Chris said, sure.
Nobody knows how cold it grows, and nobody sees how shaking my knees. Nobody cares how steep my stairs, and nobody smiles if I cross the stairs.
So he just went downstairs, and that was the first take.
It's really remarkable. Now, hearing that poor boy knowing how Chris came to that tune is it's unimaginable that it happened all at once in a way.
Well, he was a great pianist, and you know, Nick gave him a chord chart and said and they ran it down the one chorus one time around, verse and chorus, just so he knew everything, and then we pushed the button and took, and it's a great performance by Chris.
And what was Nick Drake to work with? I mean, you're tossing ideas way. He sort of seems a person. I mean, introspective is certainly the word you'd use for his music and what he writes about and how he looks at the world. He's often looking at the world as outsider looking in.
Yeah. But I mean, I think he was very private, very shy, and it was heartbreaking, really, because when he would go and play in front of people, he had such complicated tunings. It wasn't like today when you have a guitar rustler coming out after every song with a freshly tuned guitar to the new tuning that is required. He would have to sit on stage and tune his guitar to some new tuning, and he had no jokes. And people would start talking, and, you know, people didn't know who he was, they didn't care. It was very difficult and very sad, and I often think, you know, what could I have done differently? And you know, I should have had a more creative strategy for getting Nick across. But it's at least gratifying that people love the music now. People know about him now. It's just terribly, terribly sad that he never knew it.
He did a third record that was without... Well, it was just him and his guitar, right?
I think there's an element there that he was... I think he felt that Brighter Later, the second record, got a little bit away from him, that it everybody had a great time making it, including Robert Kirby and me and John Cale and Chris McGregor and everybody. But there were an awful lot of personalities on that record besides Nick's. And I think at some level, I think he felt a little more in control of Five Leaves Left. And I think Pink Moon was a reaction to Brighter Later. And I thought it was... disastrous idea just to do it with voice and guitar. But of course now Pink Moon sells way more than the other two.
Vashti Bunyan's an artist a younger audience might know, who certainly at the time I had never heard of. Tell us about her.
Well, it's the flip side of Nick's story in a way. It's the story of the artist who wasn't recognized at the time with a happy ending, because Vashti made one record with me. And by the time I finally got her in the studio, she was pregnant and had a cart and a dog and was on her way to the outer islands of Scotland to live a kind of, life with her husband way out in the wilds of nowhere. She wasn't going to tour. She wasn't going to be a pop star. I don't know why I even made the record, except I loved her music and her voice, and I thought she was wonderful. And the record duly sold less than Nick. I mean, it sold really, really small amounts. And I love the irony of the fact that it sold so few. People would pay huge amounts at vinyl auctions, and somebody paid £700 or something for a Vashti LP, and that price was mentioned in an article in Record Collector magazine, and some people who run little independent labels saw it and said, "Who's Vashti Bunyan? We better find out. If somebody's paying £750 for a Vashti Bunyan, we better find out who this person is." And they went and sought out the record, found it, got a copy or whatever. And then I helped her get the rights back from the label that owned the record. And
this is 30-something years later.
Yeah, 30 years later. And she, by this time, has grown children and plays Carnegie Hall and plays with Devendra Banhart and all these young new folk people. And
they
all love her.
Perfectly comfortable with the Incredible String Band, who would be perfectly comfortable with a lot of the musicians you work with.
Absolutely. I mean, it's great because these kids are helping to interest young audiences in some of these artists. So the whole world that we were dealing with in popular music, I suppose, in the middle 60s, from Dylan at Newport to 67, 68, you had this fantastic feeling of freshness about it. Every day that went by, you were hearing a sound that you'd never heard before, or a way of doing things that you'd never heard before. What I write in the book toward at the end, in my kind of slightly depressing summary.
to a delightful read, yeah. By the way, but go ahead and read this.
At the height of the decade, we remained optimistic in a way that today, as we watch our world being consumed from under us, is impossible to imagine. For me, the contrast between spring and autumn in 1967 in London planted the first doubts. The violence at Altamont eroded optimism for many. Charles Manson and the descent of Haight-Ashbury into squalor relieved us of a lot more. In Michael Herr's great book, Dispatches, I learned that American fighter pilots could machine gun Vietnamese farmers for sport while listening to Dylan and Hendrix on cockpit headphones. As my time at Warner Brothers Records drew to a close, which is where I worked in the early 70s, I stood on a hilltop in Laurel Canyon watching the smoke on the southern horizon as members of the Symbionese Liberation Army were incinerated by an L.A. SWAT team. By then, the ideals of the 60s were visible mostly in funhouse mirror form. In 67, we had a saying, "When the mode of music changes, the walls of the city shake." Today, when the mode of music changes, the walls of the city are covered in corporate ads sponsoring superficially subversive artists.
You see their hope, though, in people who are making now music on their own terms, in their own rooms, and they're putting it out in their own way.
Absolutely.
Could we be seeing that, you know, that 1967, I don't mean the style of music, I just mean in terms of the ability to do it.
Music business has become very democratic. And in many ways, that's a wonderful thing.
More so than when you were doing it.
Yeah. I mean, I think there were a lot of gatekeepers in my day. I mean, you know, it was an expensive process in terms of that time. And you had to get a deal in order to get into a studio. People didn't just go in and make their own records. And so from that point of view, it's very interesting and healthy that there's so many people are making records and doing things. I think it's natural for an artist to have an image in their head of how their music could sound in an ideal world. And Pro Tools and the digital technology that we have today makes it possible for them to achieve perfection. I understand where that impulse comes from, but for me, it makes for very sterile records. And you listen back to things from the 60s, and there's an awful lot of life. And by that, you often, many artists, that means mistakes or imprecise playing or accidents. And I think that's really important for records to have life. And I would only say it's great, all this music being made by people who, artists controlling their own destiny and putting their music up on MySpace and doing whatever it is. But I just wish that they would allow the music to breathe, to throw away the click track, to just play freely and let things that sound spontaneous go out into the world.
You have a thing on your website. It says, should I read it or you read it? It says, I've always adhered to the notion that I will listen to anything once, but I'm no longer seeking producing gigs. I don't have a label, and I don't go to gigs involving WPSEs, which is
white people singing in English.
I hear an awful lot of CDs by white people singing in English. We have a show called Open Mic, which are a bunch of unsigned artists who send us stuff. And I think a lot of what you say is true. I have to, just so you know, that there's hope in the world. There's an amazing amount of people who who do have that freshness and spark.
That's great. I'm really delighted. I guess I have a little problem rhythmically sometimes, you know, hearing the backbeat from the snare and the strum from the guitar. I love things like Antibalas, you know.
Which is the Brooklyn band that
doing
sort of influenced
Afrobeat.
By Fela Kuti.
Yeah, because it's like a new tack rhythmically, right. As well as being politically, you know, engaged. And I love stuff like that.
For so many years after this, all this great music of the 60s and 70s, and your music and doing music for film and so forth, you had Hannibal Records, which did incredible music, finding music from Bulgaria and all over the world. I want to thank you for that, because there's just a rich collection of music that I know I never would have heard of without you.
Well, and an awful lot of people wouldn't have heard of it without the help of people like you giving us some exposure on national radio. So thank you for that.
The Mutual Admiration Society now comes to a close. That's Joe Boyd. His book is called White Bicycles, Making Music in the 1960s. And this is the Incredible String Band.
I was a young man back in the 1960s. Yes, you made your own amusements then, going to the pictures. Well, the travel was hard and a mean way, still used the wheel, but you could sit down at your table and eat a real food made. But hey, you young people, ooh, and I just do not know, and I can't even understand you when you're trying to talk slow.
There was one fella singing those days, and he was quite good to me to say that his name was Bob Dylan.
I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.
Like your music a little country? Listen to KUT's Radio Without Borders podcast for music Austin, Texas style. Available at npr.org/podcasts.